So actually, Susan, who proposed us to give a kind of very short summary of what's been going on here. It's been many new starters for the cancer bit. And I thought with Dan that maybe the best way to do this is to just show some highlights of the talks. And the short answer, what can theory do for human health, is a lot. If you have a look of the talks that have been going around here, I'd say across the board they have been really good. And these are just some what we thought are particularly nice highlights. So first problem is what's called the influenza strain selection problem for vaccine development. And what happens with the seasonal influenza is that it's a global pandemic. It happens every year. And the timeline is such that for the vaccine strain selection, the WHO National Influenza Centers are collecting samples, and these samples are then being characterized by a smaller number of WHO collaborating centers. And it basically means that they have to isolate viruses, and they will sequence those viruses every year. And this characterization is then looking at the antigenic properties of the viruses. And this antigenic property thing decides then ultimately whether there's going to be a vaccine update or not. And the challenge there is that the strain selection for the next season's influenza is done in February. And they need to pick the one strain that is going to be the most workable in for the next year's epidemic. And it means, of course, that they need to, in fact, in some sense, predict what's going to be the dominant strain which is circulating then the next winter season. So it's a prediction up to 8 or 9 months forward in time. And it's altogether a really impressive effort, because they logistically they have to get done with all these steps on time to distribute the vaccine in September. And there are many considerations that go into this thing. We had one person from the panel here participating, so if you look at the virus talks, you will hear lots of discussion on this aspect. But the challenge is then to, at this point, decide what's the best strain to use for vaccine development. And well, how can one go about that? So the actual panel uses at the moment the antigenic data, but there's lots of genetic data and sequence data available now, and there are two concepts of adaptive evolution. So what you see here is a population evolving in time, and you have some strain and diverging by accumulating mutations, and there's an occasional beneficial mutation that then increases fitness. The fitness here is the z-axis. So there's a beneficial mutation increases, takes over the whole population, and then the population will continue exploring the sequence space by accumulating near-neutral mutations. So you see different strains diverging here. And this kind of search goes on for a while, and then there's another beneficial mutation which is discovered, and that beneficial mutation takes over the population again. And this kind of sequential sweep dynamic is something we see in some systems. And the point what was made by Michael Lessig and Marta Luxa, who work on this problem, you should have a look at the talk if you want to see the details, is that when you have a dynamical scenario like this, you are predominantly limited by monitoring. So what you are after is actually you want to have a fairly dense sampling of the population, and then you pick up these transition points where there is one strain that is becoming dominant in the population. And that's your prediction. That's going to take over the population. And there is not need necessarily for any more detailed theory than that. So predictions are, in essence, limited by monitoring. However, if the evolution looks a little bit different, that the strains are circulating in the population, but simultaneously several beneficial mutations are discovered, but on a different strain background, what results then is a clonal competition, and there can be only one winner in this, because there is no recombination within this segment. So what you can see here, that now actually at any given time point you see lots of promising strains, and then you need to decide which one of those promising strains is going to be the one that wins this race. And in fact, this scenario as well requires good quality monitoring and data, but it's not going to be soluble with data alone, but you have to be able to then predict based on the details of this this data who is going to be the winning strain in 8 months' time or 9 months' time. And that's essentially boils down to at some level of having a very good fitness model for these strains. And Michael and Marta have developed one such a model, and they then can use the model to predict what should be the pick of what strain to pick for the next year's vaccine development. And the idea there is that you pick a strain that maximizes the cross immunity overlap with all the other circulating strains. And you can then see actually how your model does by removing all the future samples from the model when you make your predict forward step. And you predict essentially what strains in the future is going to give you the best overlap with the population. And they show then a very nice paper published earlier this year. They show essentially that their predictions in some metrics, this is now not directly the antigenic distance, but I don't, it's epitope distance, is something that's related to that, will has outperformed the actual way of selecting the vaccine strains. So this is basically underlined by the fact that they have a good fitness model. So they can then project forward that 9 months. And we have seen then other talks that are essentially trying to do that bit, which is trying to use sequence data to calibrate the fitness model very carefully and then project forward. And there's a talk by Boris Ryman and Richard Nair, and what they do there is they use coalescent theory to essentially relate the shape of a genetic tree to its fitness or posterior distribution of the fitness values of the different nodes and these here. And essentially, the idea is here that depending on what's the fitness of these different variants, it will leave a trace to the shape of the tree. And they can use that shape to then predict what happens next year, what bits of the tree are going to be dominant next year. And this is again, as you can see, this is the vaccine strain prediction problem. And they use that for the same influenza data set. And the results are interesting. So what you see here is a snapshot of an influenza tree until February 2007, and the colors are highlighting the relative fitness of these strains as predicted by their approach. So red means that it's fitter than the others. And now if you add then one season extra here in gray, you can see that indeed what was the fittest predicted was the direction that the actual population went. And they can quantify the thing over duration of 15 years, and what you see here is some metric of performance metric on how well the prediction is doing compared to what happened. And you have here a baseline, which is a distance relative to a random big from the set. And you can see that they do much better for most years. Yeah. 1 or 2 years that it doesn't seem to work that well, but it turns out that sometimes you have pretty much equally fit strains there. And then if you go the other way and the actual population went the other way, then you will probably get these kind of results. But I think to me that suggests that maybe some kind of bet hedging way of doing the prediction forward would be nice. So that's something to consider. So I should say that the audience, we have the people who've done this work. So Boris, you were shaking your head. Or you just agree? Okay, good. Good. Yeah. So that's really exciting. So this is a different take on the fitness thing that Martha and Michael were discussing. And the fitness underlies the ability to predict forward. And that's needed to the vaccine strain selection. We had a third approach, and this is now quite different on the same problem. Namely, this is by Trevor Bedford. And he used now not the sequence data, but the antigenic data. And people have looked at this kind of antigenic data in lower dimensions. So they project the data to new dimensions and then see how on that space the populations move or the strains move across time. And what he has here in the black line is what he gets with his predict update Kalman field approach for the evolution of that phenotype, okay? And he can then ask the same question. If I don't have the data at the moment for the next year, what is my prediction? So I only do the predict step. And that's the red line. And he then showed quite nice results on how this kind of an approach would do for the vaccine strain selection. And what I think is really interesting for everyone here is that there's possibly going to be quite interesting improvements to be made when this phenotypic kind of way of doing is integrated with genetic data. So there are clear focal points where this can be done, because in some sense this data can be directly used to inform a fitness model for the genetic data. So that's going to be very exciting, and we look forward to hearing what happens there next. Another, I think, very interesting bit of work that we have learned about is understanding the emergence of artemisinin-resistant malaria. And I'm sure you have heard about that from the news. And there's artemisinin, which is the last remaining effective anti-malarial, is showing signs of, or pathogens that are showing signs of resistance to it are now spreading in Southeast Asia. And we had the whole series of talks on malaria, so we had a very nice insight what's going on there. So have a look of all these talks. I just want to highlight one interesting, quite difficult aspect of the problem. What I show here are two different scenarios for selection. So one is so-called hard sweep. So you have time here in this axis, and you have population frequency of a variant in the y-axis. And there's then a beneficial mutation that is discovered in the population, and it can then sweep through the population. And if that happens, what you expect to see in a let's say in a malaria parasite population is a trace like this. So you have the mutation, the beneficial mutation fixed, and you have lots of shared haplotypes across that locus. Because it's a recombining organism, it then these haplotypes are not going to cover, they're not clonal, so it's not going to be the whole population. So that's kind of textbook selective sweep. Well, there are still different kind of sweeps around. So suppose you have a much larger population, or the mutation rate to find the beneficial mutation is bigger. What can happen then is that the same mutation is discovered several times. And that kind of a soft sweep scenario, that's described by Hermansson and Fennings, Philip Messer gave a really nice talk about application of this kind of theory to malaria. The genetic signature of this kind of a soft sweep is much more difficult to see. So you have then, you still have a mutation that goes through the population, but now the haplotype signal is lost because you have, or at least it's changed. So you don't anymore have one haplotype that is discovered in the population. And you can make this even a little bit harder by saying that there is a beneficial mutation, but it doesn't have to be identical. So now the X is not going to be exactly in the same place. It might be in the same gene. So you have a slightly different variant, gives you the same fitness advantage. And as a result, population adapts to the pressure, whether that's a drug therapy or something else. You don't see from the sequence data easily what went on. So it becomes much more diffuse, the signal. And as it happens, that's what's going on in malaria with artemisinin. So people have now discovered so-called Kelch mutations. And that was a prominent theme in the malaria weeks that we had here. And Kelch mutation, what it does, it's not a full resistance phenotype in the sense that if you have that, you are still going to respond to artemisinin, but it has a dramatic effect on the clearance time, the half-life. So you appear wild-type parasites, and if you use artemisinin therapy, the clearance half-life is going to be about 3 hours. But now, these are different amino acid changes in the Kelch, and it shifts this half-life to much bigger numbers. And you can see they are close by. They hit one particular domain there. And some of them happen precisely the same mutation happens in the different background. So we have a soft sweep, but we have also soft sweep where the mutations are not identical. And it makes the genomic signature quite difficult to interpret, and indeed it makes it quite difficult to discover if you don't keep these kind of considerations in mind. And this is by talk from Ian Cheeseman, and the slides is from there. The last example is from last Thursday. It's from Michael Hochtag, and see, Mike is here, so he can comment if you have questions, and you can talk with him. What people have been talking about a lot in the first 3 weeks, especially about the situation we have with antibiotic resistance in bacteria. And one thing that we have learned here is that this bacteriophages are very interesting approach to have something else for bacterial infections. And what Mike was showing us on Thursday was the idea that you have some ancestral phage that can infect this ancestral bacteria. And suppose now you push through this phage bacteria number of cycles in an evolution experiment. So what it means that they are either co-evolving, that's one way of doing it, or one way is doing that you always take the phage and use it against ancestor bacteria. So the bacteria doesn't evolve, but the phage evolves. And if you repeat this kind of a cycle for, say, 6 rounds, you, in fact, can give the phage an advantage, an evolutionary advantage against the ancestor bacteria. So you, in fact, expose the ancestral bacteria against the phage that has now, it's basically been evolved into the future. So that's what is happening here. And why is this really interesting? I think this is a very, very nice concept. You can take bacteria from a wound and you can play this competition in vitro, and the bacteria in the wound is not evolving as quickly. So when you do this propagation in vitro, you are gaining time and you are making the phage more potent against that bacteria. And then you can actually purify that phage, put it back to the wound. And Mike also was showing us some really nice results of combination therapy with phage plus antibiotics. So that looked really exciting. And just to relate this to cancer a little bit, well, might be interesting to consider a little bit similar game in the cancer by extracting cell lines. And then you can at least evolve them parallel to the real tumor. And maybe you can expose them to different pressures. And then you already know in real time what would be that cell population in the tumor doing when exposed to this kind of different pressures. So you might gain time there. And what I thought was really cool here, that actually Mike's showing that you can go into the future in that sense. You can make the evolution faster. Okay, so I think now it's time to move to cancer. And if you have now questions, we should discuss a bit, but if not, then Bob should come here.